This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. For the last few times, I've been talking about plants and politics, and I used writings of Jamaica Kincaid, a writer from Antigua who very much resented the imposition of the British in Antigua of the kinds of gardens and plants that were not native to Antigua itself. And she writes a lot about that. I have a former student who lives in Bangalore, India, and I send him links to these programs. And he responded very affirmatively and endorsed Kincaid's resentment of what the British did when they came in to India and imposed their gardens. And he sent me a piece on the Taj Mahal about a book written by a man who researched and went back to how the gardens had been at the Taj Mahal before the British came. They had been native plants and almost like a forest, so that you came through it and suddenly there was the Taj Mahal. Most people can now visualize the very formal lawns and mirrored approach to the Taj Mahal. I thought I'd read just a little bit of this about the Taj. Today, the Taj, which draws millions of tourists a year, is surrounded by neat rectangles of manicured lawn. The gardens would have to be trimmed back, but those who saw them before spoke of how the greenery gradually revealed the mystery of the Taj's stunning facade. Homesick colonials left their imprint on India's parks and gardens, many of which are still full of tidy green lawns, trimmed hedges, and flower beds with British blooms. The British left a lasting horticultural mark on India, writes Herbert, whose book was compiled from letters and diaries of British colonialists. When the British first arrived in India in the 17th century, they discovered a continent brimming with strange but lush exotic flowers that made them yearn for their carefully tended gardens back home. And then he quotes from a letter, "The farther from home they ventured, the more they longed for the familiar cowslips and hollyhocks, Michaelmas daisies, for well-trimmed lawns and neat flower beds." In India, where outbreaks of malaria, dysentery, and other illnesses constantly brought death, many colonialists desired the comfort that a well-ordered garden could lend. The joy of recreating an English flower garden in a foreign landscape was recounted in rhapsodic terms by a military officer's wife in 1905. She writes, "My violets are in bloom," she wrote in a letter to her mother. "You cannot think how one treasures out here this quiet little home flower." Wherever the British went, Herbert notes, they took with them as part of their cultural baggage their love of gardens and their view about what a garden should look like. But the landscapes created by the British were a far cry from the extraordinary beauty of the Mughal gardens that the inspiration of the Taj Mahal is a stunning example. Despite such splendor, the British stamp on gardens remains in India. So Prashanta, my student, is very much in agreement with Jamaica Kincaid. I'm trying to use writers who had garden columns in papers or magazines. And Jamaica Kincaid had a column in The New Yorker. And this one about her feelings about the cold is quite entertaining, I think. "I always take this personally. I think frost is something someone is doing to me, only to me. And this is how winter in the garden begins, with another tentativeness, a curtsy to the actual cold to come, a gentle form of it. The effect of cold air on things growing in the garden is something I cannot get used to, cannot understand, even after so many years." She now lives in Vermont, by the way. "How can it be that after a frost, the entire garden looks as if it had been to a party in hell, as if it had been picked up and set down just outside the furnace of a baker's oven, and the oven door never shut? I must have been about 10 years old when I first came in contact with cold air. Where I lived, Antigua, the air was hot, and then hotter. And if sometimes, usually in December, the temperature at night got down to 75 degrees, you wore a sweater and a flannel blanket was put on the bed. Once the parents of a girl I knew got a refrigerator, and when they were not home, she asked me to come over and put my hand in the freezer. I was convinced then, and remain so now, that cold air is unnatural, man-made, associated with prosperity, refrigerators being common in the prosperous North, and more real, as the artificial always seems, and special than the warm air that was so ordinary to me. And then when I moved to the prosperous North, I became suspicious of cold air, because it also seemed associated with the dark. With the cold comes the dark. In the dark, things grow pale and die, and no explanation from science or nature of how the sun can shine brightly in the deep of winter has ever been satisfactory to me. In my heart, I know that the cold and the light, the winter and the summer, cannot be at the same time. In a chapter in her book, my garden book, Jamaica Kincaid writes about possible gifts that a gardener might give other gardeners. And one of the gifts she talks about is garden books. And she does know about Vita Sackville-West, the woman whose gardens I want to talk about. Huge and beautiful gardens, palatial gardens, and a castle. A real castle that the gardens lead to. And Jamaica Kincaid says, I have been to Sissinghurst. That's the name of Vita's gardens. I have read Jane Brown's Sissinghurst Portrait of a Garden. All of the great gardeners I know love this garden and everything connected to it, especially its creators, Vita Sackville-West and her husband. It is a beautiful garden, an extraordinary creation, and yet I remain unmoved by it, perhaps because I have read too much of Sackville-West's own writing. The best of her garden writing has been collected by Robin Lane Fox, an extraordinary gardener himself, in an anthology called The Illustrated Garden Book. I suspect that the source of my antipathy to Sackville-West and her garden is to be found in her observations of the garden, in the way she manages to be oblivious of the world. For the fact is, the world cannot be left out of a garden. At least I find that to be so, and that's why I regard Nina Simone's autobiography as an essential companion volume to my work, to any work by Vita Sackville-West. And then I'd like to turn to Vita's own writing and writing about her. For nearly 15 years, Vita Sackville-West enchanted the readers of the Observer newspaper with her weekly column on gardening. Writers on gardening need two very different skills. They must be able to garden and also to write. Vita Sackville-West had been a writer since her youth, a poet, novelist, and biographer. She and her husband, Harold Nicholson, had already made The Great Garden at Sissinghurst Castle in Kent. Her readers knew she was busy with ideas and that the ideas she suggested and wrote it with authority of a great garden maker and planter. She also contrived a style, a simple personal tone, with literary allusions and an artful air of romance. Thousands of non-gardeners read her pieces until she stopped because they were so good. There had never been such a gardening column until she stopped in 1961. Her readers gave weekly proof of it. They wrote to her. They sent her seeds, ideas, and presents. When she sent plants in reply, they thanked her in romantic idiom, which seemed appropriate. In rationed post-war Britain, they sent her knickknacks for her garden, advice on how to keep the sparrows off the primroses, and requests for inspiration with their own designs. When she wrote enthusiastically about an unusual strawberry tree, the post office had to send a special van to Sissinghurst in order to deliver the bags of readers' inquiries. And so I'd like to give you a feeling of Vita's own writing. This very short book is very personal and therefore very arbitrary. It represents nothing more than a couple of dozen among the plants I like to grow in my own garden. And at first sight, it may seem that there are no connecting links in this choice of plants at all. I hope I can explain that there are. The book is addressed not to the professional, but to the amateur gardener. This country is a country of garden lovers, and it contains many who, getting perhaps a little bored with growing exactly the same things as their neighbors year after year, look round for a few extras which shall come well within the scope of their purse, time, and knowledge. We can all grow our wallflowers, lupins, delphiniums, or snapdragons. Far be it from me to run any of these down any of these valuable allies, but the moment always comes when the taste of every true flower lover turns towards something less usual and obvious. It is this type of gardener that I have in mind. Although each of the flowers I have chosen to describe is comparatively easy to grow and inexpensive to buy, it has, I think, a quality of its own and is something which is not always seen in every garden. And then, because of Brian and his love for irises, I'll read just a little bit of her garden column on Iris reticulata. When flowers come so thick in summer that one hesitates which to pick among them so many, one is apt to forget the bare cold days when the earth is a miser, offering only one or two, take it or leave it. Wrapped in mufflers and overcoats, we go and peer about for a stray sprig of winter sweet, a splashed and muddy hellebore, a premature violet, anything to fill one solitary glass with some pretense of spring long before spring has really arrived. There are the bulbs, of course, which one has carefully plunged in ashes or placed in a dark cupboard according to the instructions in the garden books and catalogs. But somehow, there is always something a little artificial about any flower which has been compelled to bloom before its time. Even though we may not number ourselves among the rich who languidly fill their rooms on an order to a florist with lilacs at Christmas and tulips on New Year's Day, there is still, I think, a great difference between flowers which we force and those which we have the patience to wait for in their proper season. For one thing, the forced flower always slightly spoils our delight in its indoor successor when it normally arrives. And for another, the forced flower itself, however welcome, is always something of a fake. To the lover of flowers, these arguments are disturbingly potent. The moral of all this is that we especially welcome any flower which lightens the gloom of winter of its own accord. The more fragile and improbable looking, the better. Such a flower is Iris reticulata. It seems extraordinary that anything so gay, delicate, and brilliant should really prefer the rigors of winter to the amenities of spring. It is true that we can grow Iris reticulata in pots under glass if we wish to do so, and that the result will be extremely satisfying and pretty. But far more pleasing is the virtue of Iris reticulata that will come into bloom out of doors as early as February, with no coddling or forcing at all. Purple flecked with gold, it will open its buds even above the snow. The ideal place to grow it is in a pocket, rather rich, though well-drained soil, amongst stones, a private place which it can have all to itself for the short but grateful days of its consummation. Iris reticulata, the netted iris, not the flower is netted, but the bulb. The bulb wears a little fibrous coat like a miniature fishing net. It is a native of the Caucasus, and there is a curious fact about it. The Caucasian native is reddish, whereas the European garden form is the true imperial purple. Botanists, including W.R. Dykes, the greatest authority on irises, have been puzzled by the Mendelian characteristics exhibited by this group. Mr. Dykes received bulbs from the Caucasus, which were always reddish. The garden form was purple, and yet the seedlings raised from the garden form were always reddish again. It was only the fourth generation, raised from seed, that he obtained the purple form, and even that differed slightly in color from the fixed garden type. It is unlikely that any of us will wish to experiment with our own saved seeds in this way, but I still throw it out as a suggestion to those who have the inclination and the leisure. Let me warn those enthusiasts that they will have to wait at least 4 years between the sowing of the seed and the flowering of the bulb. In the meantime, I do suggest that every flower lover should grow a patch of little reticulata somewhere in his garden. Let me also draw his attention to the variety known as reticulata contab, rather expensive at present, which is a bright blue, gentian blue. However, being an expensive treasure, it is better grown in a pot under glass. It would be a pity to buy it and then lose it. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.